The following presentation was recorded at the 1996 Teachers Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
That you're who you should be. So the teacher as an example of excellence, goals, and methods. The topic here is considerably more specific. The topic assigned to me is considerably more specific. So I would like to divide this into two sections. First of all, it's already divided into two sections. But I would like to divide goals into two sections. First of all, personal goals. The teacher as an example of excellence, goals, and methods. Under goals, I think we should have personal goals and we should have school goals. Personal goals, there's a statement that goes like this. The bucket must be bigger than the dipper. The bucket must be bigger than the dipper. And I think it's a very apt, colorful word picture. You get the picture of a little bucket and a big dipper and trying to get anything out of that bucket, and it's a little difficult. So you're the bucket and the students are the dippers, and you want to make sure that your bucket is big and full. So when those dippers go in there, those little dippers go in there, there's something they can get. And they can get something, and they can get something good, and it can come out. So maybe there's another bulletin board illustration. The teacher is the bucket, or maybe the Bible's the bucket, or you develop that the way you like. Personal goals, and I'm not really here talking about personal discipline, so this is going to be very brief. I think you should read widely. Read widely. Don't just read the stuff that you have to read to teach your class tomorrow morning. But expose yourself to reading. If you've never read Stephen Crane's The Red Badge of Courage, read it. How many of you have read it? Okay, a few hands out there. The rest of you, if you've never read it, you can probably read it in two evenings. Very easy reading. It's a classic. It's not Christian. It's not Mennonite. But it's a classic that will do you some good. If you've never read the book of Micah and paid any attention to it, read it and spend a little time with it. You can read the book of Micah in just a few minutes, really. So read widely. I think it's read poetry. I think that'll be very helpful. I think you should also work. I know teaching's work, but you should also bake pies and chop wood and, you know, wash diapers and whatever, you know, do other things besides. I don't really like to see people become thoroughly academics or they don't do anything else. I think that, I mowed hay Monday and I'm planning to bale it tomorrow, and you may not have the opportunity to farm, but you can all go out and dig around the garden somewhere. And I think teachers should also work. I don't like the idea, and I think Milo dealt with it well this morning by saying you can compartmentalize life. I don't think our families should look at us as people who are really smart and we're these academics and we're way up above everybody else. I think we should get our hands dirty and get our knees dirty and do some work besides that. So some personal goals. You should also have convictions. I'm not telling you what they should be, but when you go into classroom, you should have some convictions. Out of which, or from which, you can answer questions. So, just a few suggestions. Have personal goals. Now, of course, we're talking about school, so I need to be more specific about school goals. And I've got seven of them here. Number one, each student become what God wants them to be. Each student become what God wants this young man or woman to be. That should be a goal that you have for your classroom. And my wife was helping me work on some of these. Lois was helping me with these. Each student become what God wants that student to be. That should be a goal for you. Not become what you want that person to be, but become what God wants that person to be. And you need to help them achieve that. Be sensitive to who they are and what they are. If they have trouble learning, then don't force things on them that they can't do. We'll talk a little bit more about that. Another goal, number two, notice all students, especially in grade school. It's easy to notice the little girl who's always got her hair combed, the little boy's always got his shoes tied, you know, and it's easy to think of them as A students. And You know, they always sit there nice and straight and look at you, and they believe everything you say. And it's easy to think of them as the best students in the class. It's important that you notice all students. And it's a little bit difficult for me to do here today, but in a classroom where you're the teacher and you have students you see every day, you need to make eye contact with every student. That's what I think. Now, 2 or 3 second eye contact is probably what's appropriate. And we can't get too specific here. You know, you don't want to just bore somebody with your eyes, or anybody feels uncomfortable if you do that. On the other hand, I've watched teachers teach who teach like this. You know, in college this might be okay, but not in your school. You know, they teach like this, and then they teach like this. And I've observed teachers for a half an hour not look at the class. That's not going to work in your school. I don't think it's going to work in your school. Make eye contact. Notice the students. Don't make them uncomfortable with your eye contact. But if you've got somebody who's out of place, you've got a girl who's doing her English in your math class, just give her a little of that eye contact, you know, so she knows, you know, what she's doing. Or if you got some fellow who's doing something he shouldn't be, you know, every now and then somebody will bring a magazine along and they'll hide it in behind their lit book, and they're looking at something that's not supposed to be at school, like a book about motorbikes or cars or whatever. Well, just give them a lot of eye contact. Or sometimes with fellas, I give them a little body contact. You know, I'll go back and just lean against them a little bit, and so they know that I'm there. Notice the students. Notice. And just let me detour into this just a little bit. I take complete privilege to confiscate anything at school I don't think is appropriate. Somebody's looking at a magazine, I don't care if it's in study hall, I don't care if it's in the hallway. If I think it shouldn't be there, I say, thank you very much, I'll take that. Next contact is with mom or dad, and you know, then we discuss this a little bit. So we're noticing the students. You know, maybe at your school nobody does that sort of thing, I hope not. But it seems like at most schools, or, well, teenagers are just like, you know, some of you may still be teenagers, but as we were teenagers, we did things we shouldn't have done. It will probably happen at your school. When it does, I believe in intervention. Notice the students. Number 3, and this applies to high school. It would not apply as much to grade school. Fail those students who don't care, and help the ones who are helpless. I don't know how to say it any nicer. If you have a student who just notoriously refuses to do work when you know that they're capable, then don't fudge the grades so they pass. Let them take consequences for that. I think that's a goal. The goal here is to help those who have difficulty and to make a strong impression on those who can do the work, but just decide they won't do it this time. You know, don't fudge the grades in your book to make them look good. If somebody doesn't turn something in, just give them a Cheerio for it, okay? So that's a little rough on the grades, and mom and dad want to know why the Cheerio is done. Well, they didn't turn it in, so they don't have a grade there. My defense for the rationale for this would be what I think of as God's grading system. I don't think God is going to grade all of you the same way. Some of you have 1 talent, some 2, some 5. You're going to be graded differently by God. And when you deal with your classroom, I know we can get in a long discussion about this, but in my classroom, I don't grade people all the same way. If I have a student who's working hard, they're diligent, they attempt, they do their job, they work, it may not be an excellent work as we would look at it academically, but if they have done their best, I will not fail a student like that. I don't think God fails anybody who does their best. If you do your best, God won't fail you. But if I get some really smart young man who just thinks he can get away with murder, excuse the word, just not do anything or just carry on, whatever, I just don't mind putting an F on that report card and putting on there not working up to ability. That's a goal that I have for the school, and I think it's an appropriate goal. Number 4, preserve an Anabaptist worldview. What's that? Well, come to Faith Builders and find out. I guess I'll just lean on Harold Bender quickly. Anabaptist worldview. Belief in personal discipleship, community, and non-resistance. Was that Harold Bender? I think so. So preserve an Anabaptist worldview. Think of what it means to be Mennonite and attempt to preserve that. Don't try to destroy that or to challenge it. Number five, teach students how to think. How in the world would we do that? Teach students how to think. To learn, to discover. It's easy, sort of easy, to teach people what to think, but teaching them how to think takes more time and more effort. And the way I do this is, one way I do it is to give them what I call thought responses. I'll write something on the board, and I'll say, okay, during this class period, I would like you to respond to the statement on the board. You have all class period to do it, or I might give them 20 minutes to do it. They write it out, they turn it in, I read it. And by the way, when students turn in work, I read every word of it. I think that's only integrity that you, or maybe I'm just scared, because in high school I had a social studies teacher who used to give us worksheets, everyday worksheets, 3-4 questions on there. And the next day they always came back, and if you had something written down, you got credit. If you didn't, you got no credit. And one day, one of the smart girls, you know, there's always a few girls in the class that are real smart, and one of them who decided she could afford to risk wrote as an answer, "Do you really read these things?" And next day it came back with a good grade on it, so she walked up and showed it to him. And that's not the kind of thing you want to get caught in as a teacher, okay? For example, if one of your students writes something and you turn the paper back and then that student says to you, "What did you think about what I wrote on that paper?" And you say, "Yeah, let's see, which line was that?" So I think it's only integrity when students write things, you read it. You may not always have time to make as many comments as you want, but at least read what they've written so you can respond. Let me give you some examples of things that I've written on the board over the years. One in Bible class was, and I realize this applies more to high school than to grade school, was Jesus not able to sin, or was Jesus able not to sin? Was Jesus not able to sin, or was Jesus able not to sin? Was he not able or able not? Well, now the students really have to think a little bit. And of course I say include some biblical material here to defend your answer. So they got out their Bibles and, oh, they hate these things, you know. But they learn so much, and they learn to process information. They really have to think, you know. Students love when you say 1 plus 1 equals 2, and then on the test you put 1 plus 1 equals blank. They can put in 2. That's pretty nice. But when you ask them, for example, another one I've used is, "The Industrial Revolution was the Trojan horse of modern society. Explain." Oh, dear. Now you have to know what the Trojan horse was. Or let's see, I got a few others I wrote down here. Another one is, and this could be adapted almost to any grade level, "Write a history of your church or your congregation." Now that's not something you do in class, that's something you take home. And when I have my students write a history of their church or their congregation, one of the requirements is they have to interview an older member of the congregation and ask them, "How were things when you were young?" And that's a person who's supposed to be 70 or older. Okay? They're also supposed to sketch their church. So they have to look at things a little differently than they've ever looked at them before. They have to go visit somebody or talk to them after church. This is something everybody has access to. You're not asking them to do something they can't do, but it forces them to think. They also have to put a little pocket in the folder when they turn it in. In there, they have to have a copy of their church's discipline. I also have them memorize their baptismal vows. You know, many people don't know their baptismal vows. Memorize the baptismal vows. Well, now they have to think a little bit. And it's really in the study in Bible doctrine, when we study about Satan, that I have them memorize their baptismal vows. seems strange, but every set of baptismal vows I've seen so far have a phrase in there, have a little statement in there, willing to renounce Satan on all his wicked ways. Okay? Amazing. And so it gets them to thinking and putting things together, helping to teach students how to think. You can get younger students to bring in specimens of weeds or insects. Okay? They have to find the bug and they have to identify it. This is a way of teaching students how to think, not just what to think. In psychology class, I get them to write on the subject, the world is a Skinner box. Agree, disagree, explain. Use biblical data. Okay? That's the type of thing. I get them to write on reflect on European settlement of North America. Was that good or wasn't it? Write it from the Native American point of view. Write it from the European point of view. Okay? Don't just take life for granted, in other words. Another thing I get them to do, and I just did this last, was 2 weeks ago, when there was a Brethren Institute at which I was teaching. And I was teaching the book of 1 Corinthians, and I had students write a paraphrase of 1 Corinthians 13. That was their homework assignment. That's not really difficult. And I'm not sure how you feel about paraphrasing, but for example, I gave them a little example of a teacher's paraphrase. It might go something like this. Though I speak with the tongues of Shakespeare and Aristotle and have not charity, I am nothing. And so I was fascinated to see the responses that came in. One of the girls in the class was a baker. And she wrote, though I bake with the ability of Betty Crocker and Pillsbury and have not charity, I am become as a flopped cake. And so this is a way of forcing the student to use that student's own creativity to make the scripture really applicable to them. Maybe some of you are sensitive and think that that's not appropriate. But what I don't think that that girl will ever be able to read 1 Corinthians 13 again without saying, ooh, that applies to the way I bake cakes. And I think it does. So what I would like to, and I'm making this a little bit too long, but another assignment that I've given students over the years is to take notes on the sermon. Monday morning, notes are due on my desk on Sunday's sermon. Can be Sunday morning, Sunday evening, Sunday school, take your pick. If you're not going to be at church for whatever reason, you can do it on Wednesday night prayer meeting. But Monday morning, there are notes due on my desk from the sermon. And almost any age group, you can ask grade schoolers to write down the text and a few things the minister said. That changes the whole chemistry of the way they approach church. They go in there taking notes, and their friends ask them what they're doing, and it gets a little embarrassing. Well, okay, moving on to the section on methods. We'll let goals in our past here and look at methods. We might have to go just a few minutes over time here. I think with your methods, it's important to have structure, but within that structure, then use some variety. And just as an example, I would give, I really think you should have a seating arrangement. Now, some teachers don't. We'll just sit wherever you feel like it. I think you should have a seating arrangement. I think the worst thing you can do in upper grades is make it alphabetical, because they've been sitting beside these people for forever, they think, you know. As soon as you say we're going to sit, I'm going to give you a seating arrangement, and you start reading the names alphabetically, they all just go to their seats. You know, they know where they're going to be. You don't even have to read the whole list. So just for varieties, you know, go A and then Z and then B and then jump around in the alphabet. I also change seats every quarter. You might want to do it every month. I use the lot to determine who sits where. On the way back from chapel, I'll have a little basket, and I'll have papers in there with numbers of all the seats. And, of course, they come in, and I hold it high enough so they can't see in. They have to pick their number. And then I just read off 1, 2, 3, and they just fall in their seat. That way there's no accusing me that I made you sit beside somebody you didn't like or whatever. Okay. Of course, all these seats are subject to change without notice, if there's any reason why that should happen. But what I'm saying is have some variety within the structure. And sometimes, when the quarter ends, we'll come back from chapel and we'll pick our numbers. I'll start in the back with number one, just for a little variety, or else I'll go down this way, back and forth. Okay. Be careful with your methods. I think some methods can encourage dishonesty. Now, I know you don't have any dishonest students at your school, but at our school, it seems like each summer I get a few letters in the mail expressing concern over what somebody did last year and asking forgiveness for it. And of course, I always keep that confidential, and I always respect people with that sensitive conscience. But when I see teachers using worksheets, and if this is something you can use and it works well for you, that's fine. But to use worksheets where everybody has the same worksheet, and it's the questions at the end of the chapter, and they're supposed to do it at home, I've seen 6 people do them and 10 people copy them. If it's helpful for you and it works for you, fine. But be careful about using the type of method that might encourage some dishonesty. And I'm not saying that we're giving the students an out and we're treating them like, they can't handle integrity. But somehow it's worked better for me. When you do your lectures, lecture is a method. When you walk into class, you might have 24 bodies out there, but you might only have 6 of the minds. The other 18 might be somewhere far away. They might still be at last night, or still be at what happened at the breakfast table, or what happened on the way to school. So you need to be some way to get those people all with you before you begin, at least not so much in grade school, but in high school. Typically, the way I start a high school class is I'll just mingle with the students and be talking with someone about what they were doing. And I think you really need to know your students. Find out, if their grandma's sick or their cat died or, what, they had a baby brother in their family. You can't know everything, but you can at least know a few things. And maybe you can be discussing that with a student. And as the bell rings, you can sort of, continue the discussion and raise your voice and include everyone in and make sort of an application about it. And the next thing you know, class has started, and they didn't even know what happened. When you do lectures, you should, I think, know what you're talking about. Nothing will get you in so much trouble as not to know what you're talking about. Or just trying to stay a half a chapter ahead of the students in the science book or something like that. You might be able to get away with that with some students, but you'll be caught with it too. So have some answers and know your facts. And I also think we should learn how to draw conclusions and bring closure to discussions. If you have class discussions that maybe get on issues, or maybe a little child will say, my grandma got sick, or my grandpa died, take a few minutes to talk about it and bring some closure to it. Talk about God's view of death and what happens at death, and how we should feel about that, and how there could be some hurt in their family. Bring some closure to it. If you just say, oh, that's nice, and go on, you probably didn't even hear what they said. So I think it's important to bring closure and conclusion. On to the subject of projects. I love to give projects, and please, when you give projects, don't get busy work. You know what busy work is? The type of classroom where you walk in where on Monday, you have a lecture on the chapter. On Tuesday, you're supposed to do the thought questions at the end of the chapter. And on Wednesday, you review. And on Thursday, break it up a little bit more than that. And that some of that can turn into busy work. You understand what I'm saying? Vary it so it's not just busy work. For example, a project that I've enjoyed giving to history students is list for me the 3 most important people who ever lived. Write a paragraph about each one. Tell me why. List the 3 most important inventions of all time. The 3 most important discoveries. Now they're over there digging through the world books and talking to their dads. And projects that have some real value. I like to give book reports, which are projects, which have specific directions. One of them that I do in church history is read 3 pages from Men of Simons. You'd be surprised how many Mennonite homes do not have a copy of the complete work of Men of Simons. They should. I always recommend to students that they give one to their parents for Christmas or their birthday or their anniversary or something. You know, if you don't have one, be surprised how many Mennonite homes do not have a copy of Martyr's Mirror. Well, buy Dad one for his next birthday or something, or mother or somebody, just so you have one in the house. Read 3 pages from Men of Simons and write a 1-page article, your own, about what Menno wrote on this subject. I think that's a helpful project, and you can do it at almost any grade level. You can get parents to read to students. I think hands-on projects are good. I think maybe the best project I've ever done is to have students make a topographical map of the land of Palestine. It's messy, and you'll hate yourself. You'll say, I'll never do this again, and the room will look a mess, but I tell my students that when I'm old in a rest home or a museum or wherever they put me, they'll probably forget everything I said, but they'll remember those topographical maps. You know, or they learned that Mount Hermon is 9,200 feet above sea level, and the Sea of Galilee is, 500 feet below the Sea of Galilee, below sea level. And they learned that when you come in off the Mediterranean, you have the coastal plain and the Shephela and the hill country and the Jordan River Valley and the Jordan Plateau, and they're in there with their hands smearing this stuff all around, you know, and then they're painting it different colors for different elevations. Great project. It's a mess, but they'll learn so much from it, you know. Projects that are valuable and helpful. What about tests? Well, of course, we have to have tests. Right? I think on tests you should use a various type of tests, varying types of questions. You should have some multiple choice questions, some true and false, some fill in the blank, some essay. Some people are great at essay questions. You know, they love to write. They can take one fact and make it sound like a World Book article. You know, you give them a good grade for it, and somebody else might list 6 or 7 facts, but they don't have it all worked out in nice essay form. And you might give this person who had one fact, and be careful about that sort of thing. And let's see. I've got some grading sheets here. You made copies of these, right? You might just pass them down. For example, you'll see these. Well, I'll talk about something else till you get the papers. Let's talk about tests till you get the papers. You can make a test that nobody can pass, or you can make a test that I couldn't pass, nobody can pass, make a test that you can't pass yourself, just by asking all the hard questions that nobody knows the answers to. When you teach, I think it's important that you kind of teach toward a test, and then you can, of course, everybody's going to read my papers and try and figure out the answers on the back, and nobody will pay attention. Oh, dear. let me give you a little suggestion. Make 70%, thank you, Clint. 70% of your questions, fairly manageable, easy questions, so that anybody can pass the test by getting 70% of the questions correct. Then make another 20% real challenging. Not overly challenging, but challenging, so that the people who want a better grade are going to have to dig in, and make 5% difficult and 5% impossible. That way, you know, people that really study can get a 95, and people that are bright and really work at it can maybe get a 98 or 100. I also think that you should not put the most difficult questions right up front. Make the first question impossible. That's not good. Don't do that. I know this is not a session on test construction, but we're talking about methods. If you make that first test question impossible, some students are just going to wilt right on the spot. Make the first one easy so that people get the idea that, well, I think I can handle this test. Most of us don't like to be thrown impossible things right away. I also like to put extra credit questions on tests. Like, for example, You can put the extra credit question on the board. You can pull the map down over it so they can't see it. You can ask a question like, what was the chapel speaker's text this morning? Or what's the verse on the sign in front of the school? Or, you know, something that they should have noticed and didn't. Of course, then everybody will be asking to go to the lab so they can peek out the window, but you don't let anybody do that. All right. About grading, on the sheet here, you should see on one side something about grading. Okay. Thank you. Typically, when I do grading, if I give a report, I'll also give, along with the assignment, a report grade. Now, this is two copies here. It's two different ones. One's for a report, one's for a book report. The reason I'm doing this, and I'm just giving this to you, you can use it if you want. You don't need to give me any credit for it. I'm not sure where I got it. This way, you have something to grade when you give back the report. On the book report, when they're doing their book report, they know that they're going to get some sort of a grade on general appearance. They know they're going to get 5 points for introduction if they do it well. They know they'll get 10 points for a biblical evaluation. So when they read this book, regardless what book it is, they're supposed to give it a biblical evaluation. Were there things in this book that were not biblical? Were there things that were? And you can evaluate this, and then when you go to grade, you don't have to sit there and agonize and say, oh, did they do a good job on this book report or didn't they? And your mind doesn't have to go back to whether this person keeps their hair combed and their shoes tied, but you can look at it academically and give them a grade for their academic excellence. That's the idea of using a piece of paper like this. And you can give them an empty sheet like this when you give out the assignment. Tell them to staple it inside the back cover of their report. When you get there, you just fill it out. And they know what you're looking for, and I think it makes life a lot easier. Okay. I also think it's a good idea to at least occasionally, I think we're going to run until 10:30. Will that be okay? We'll shorten up our break here just a little bit. Occasionally give essay questions. If you have a high school class and a large class, and you give a test that's a two-page essay, you're going to be a candidate for trouble, because you can only grade so many essay questions and do it appropriately and accurately and excellently. You just can't do it. Well, some people can. I had a professor in college who, he gave us blue book, you know, two blue books. If you know what blue books are, you write two of these. You think your mind was going to explode or something. Well, he'd sit up in front there at a table and he'd grade these as fast as it came in. And it was disconcerting just to sit back there and take his tests because he knew he was up there with the red pen. But most of us as teachers can't do that. Okay? Agreed? I can't do that. I can't grade them as fast as they come in, which is what he tended to do. And I think he did a good job. He was just fast. Be careful about overloading yourself with your methods. You know, it's nice to give essay questions because you don't have to make up a test. But if you're going to do that, prepare to spend the next couple evenings enjoying them. I also think that field trips are a great idea. They take time. They need planning. Take some moms or dads along. Don't take 30 people someplace with no moms or dads or board members. Don't do that. Explain field trips before you go. When you come back from them, debrief them. What did you learn? Maybe write a little bit about it and read their paragraphs they wrote. I also think group projects are good because they encourage cooperation. Someone has said that in school we teach people for 12 years to be individuals, then as soon as they graduate, we expect them to know how to cooperate. So let's give them cooperation exercises. I have even given cooperative tests that when students came into the room, they knew they were having a test, and I had the desks arranged in groups of three. I had a test, one test paper on each. I had three names on it. I said, go around, find your name, sit down there. That's your test. You three work together. You all get the same grade. That's a little scary. And the people that don't like it are the ones who have the high averages, you know, because they see their average melting right down into the floor. And of course, the ones who love it are the ones that never can pass these things, and now they see a way out. because I always put a group together where you've got somebody who really knows what they're doing and some other people who aren't sure what's happening. Try and put them in the same group, and you'll be amazed what kind of cooperation you'll get. Just wonderful. Another thing I've done as a group project is to read Martyr's Mirror stories. You know, in the Martyr's Mirror, there are places where you have the speaker indicated and what the speaker said. You'll have the, I suspect you're familiar with this, you'll have the Anabaptist person who was maybe on trial, you'll have a witness, you'll have a civil authority, and these people, it's recorded what they said. And all you have to do is make copies of that and highlight areas and say, okay, you three young ladies come up here, and I'll need two men, you come up here, and I give them each their sheets, and they read their parts. It's a cooperative learning experience. The students, we didn't know that was in the Martyr. Was that in the Martyr's Mirror? What page is that on? You get a lot of interest in it, and the students seem to enjoy it. Well, I have 4 minutes. Do you have questions or comments? Anyone? Next section, we'll talk about the rhyme and reason on the back, okay? If I forget, remind me. Question? Yes, question right here.
This is one before.
Yes. Okay. Well, hopefully this is not something you'll just use, but hopefully this is something you'll adapt. Just strike out what you don't like and make your own, and make it adaptable to you. Okay. Any other questions or comments before we break? Yes, sir.
When you have three students like that doing the test together, how do you keep from just them just letting the one that knows it all just do it all?
Well, that's a problem. That's a problem. I've done it two ways. I've done it notebook and I've done it open book. And typically, there's enough time pressure that everyone... I make so that there's enough time pressure that everyone has to help. Okay. That is a problem. There's always a problem. And occasionally it happens. Okay, anyone else? Well, thank you very much.
My Anabaptist class has been getting discussion questions for the test, and I don't like this entirely, but the last one, I changed my questions. They were a little different than I had given before, and they weren't tried and tested. And this class pled that they could take this test together, because the questions were, I think some of them knew a lot more about some of the questions than they did other of the questions. But that was interesting to me, because I tried to get classes before to take tests together so I could promote the community, and I couldn't get them to do it because they thought they could do better alone. I thought that was interesting.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.